And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is An Organic Conversation with Helga Hellberg.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, relationships, and life itself. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. I hope you had a great week. Thank you for all your inquiries that we received. Lilia from Los Angeles, California, is commenting on my intro last week, The Touch of the Cook, and writes that her sister, who was speech impaired and passed away 2 years ago, had the ability to completely express herself through cooking. Much more than a chef creating beautiful dishes, she was able to let you see inside of her with every meal she prepared. This happened every time she cooked, and complete strangers would be deeply touched by her food. Lilia from Los Angeles, thank you. Phelim Lani from Marin County, California, suggests that it may be a good time to remove the word natural from the organic conversation until there is a certification process for natural foods and products. Thank you, Phelim. You are raising a really good point. Well, actually, the term natural is defined both by USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, and also the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and generally describes products that contain no artificial ingredients, artificial colorings, or chemical preservatives. And in regard to enforcement, there have been lawsuits, for example, against Snapple, but it is true that there's no certification process in place, like in organic, where annual inspections by independent third-party certifiers are required by federal law. In this radio show, we are focusing on organic foods and products, so if the term natural has slipped into the conversation, we apologize to some degree. That was not our intention, and for us, there's a clear and distinct line between natural products and certified organic products. However, for us, an organic conversation must allow all points and topics to be looked at and talked about, and yes, it's good to be clear as possible in this regard, and we'll have a show about food labels coming up soon. So thanks again, Phelim from Marin County, California, for allowing us to clarify this. Lots of listeners shared stories about the attempt to have their parents or friends or partners eat healthier and eat organic foods, with quite hilarious suggestions and strategies, and we are thinking about an entire show dedicated just to that. So soon more on this one. If you have a great story to tell or a comment or question, please email us at share@anorganicconversation.com. In a show a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the language of flavor, that each variety of strawberries or mangoes or cherries has its distinct and unique language, its distinct and unique expression through its particular taste. The beauty of diversity, a world of language. Today, I want to reverse this notion. Instead of the language of flavor, I want to talk about the flavor of language. A couple of years ago, I met a man from Lapland, which is the northern area of Norway, Sweden, and Finland, at Terra Madre, a gathering of food communities from around the world in Torino, Italy, organized by Slow Food. He was Salmon, a reindeer herder, and he was wearing his beautiful clothing made out of felted wool and reindeer leather. We ate some food together, and in our conversation, he shared that he knew 300 words to describe snow. He had a word for any kind of snow: slushy, dry, thick. Snow that had freshly fallen, snow that had fallen on old snow that had turned to ice, snow that was about to melt, and a word for snow that would melt in a few hours, and 295 other words. For him, there was nothing nostalgic about this, because he knew that his survival was depending on it. 300 words for snow, shared with other reindeer herders to discuss what the safest route to take would be on their 1,000-mile-long trek from the endless grazing areas of the tundra in northern Scandinavia to the place where some of his herd would be slaughtered and sold, just for him to start the journey all over again. 26 letters, the alphabet, a universe of possibility and diversity, all needed to describe the subtleties of nature and all of her endless expressions. The salmon and I were sharing food, And I guess food can come in the form of words and language as well. According to Webster's dictionary, food is defined as something that nourishes us, and nourishment is defined as to foster and sustain life. His 300 words for snow are sustaining his life, and his story has nourished me ever since. You're listening to An Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break. And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg, and I'm excited about our guest today. Talk about the nourishment in words, Lisa Hamilton, one of the most talented and endearing food writers I had the pleasure to work with many times in my life, and she's the author of a new book. But first, as always, here's Dan McGovern with the news.
Good morning. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation, and I'm Dan McGovern. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration said this week it wants to prohibit routine applications of antibiotics in livestock to help cut down the spread of drug-resistant bacteria in people. For years, the American Medical Association and other medical groups have argued that widespread use of antibiotics to boost the growth of farm animals increases the number of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in commercial meats and poultry. Organic practices have always prohibited the use of antibiotics in animals for reasons other than to restore its health. If an antibiotic is used to restore an animal to health, that animal cannot be used for organic production. A top FDA official made the statement Monday during a congressional hearing on legislation that would phase out the non-therapeutic use of 7 antibiotics for livestock. A wastewater treatment plant in San Francisco is the nation's first to generate renewable energy using food waste, diverting it from landfills, which are the second largest source of human-caused methane in the United States. The East Bay Municipal Utility District is collecting food waste from Bay Area restaurants and food processors and dumping it into large containers called anaerobic digesters. Food waste decomposes inside the digester, producing methane to power the treatment plant. Material remaining after the digestion process can be composted and used as a natural fertilizer to help grow food. The facility plans on increasing the amount of food waste processed to its maximum capacity of 200 tons per day. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that if 50% of food waste in the United States was anaerobically digested, enough electricity would be generated to power approximately 2.5 million homes for a year. Florida has instituted the first regulation in the nation, and perhaps the world, that prohibits any additives, chemicals, or adulterants in honey produced, processed, or sold in the state. Florida Agriculture and Consumer Services Commissioner Charles Bronson said too often in the past, honey sold as pure in the state is cut with water or sugar and sometimes even contaminated with insecticides or antibiotics. Under the new law, honey containing anything other than the natural food product resulting from the harvest of nectar by honeybees is considered an adulterated or mislabeled product. Such products would be banned from sale in the state, and repeat offenders would face fines of up to $500 per violation. Bronson said if producers mix honey with other products, it can be sold, but must be clearly labeled as a blended product. Florida is the fourth leading honey-producing state in the country, generating over $15 million in sales last year. This is Sustainable Food News, your weekly news service on An Organic Conversation. I'm Dan McGovern.
Thank you, Dan, for that news update. And let's dive into that honey story for a second. Florida, you said it's the first regulation in the nation.
Possibly the world. It's definitely a first. And the impetus behind it, the honey industry, Florida had a flood, what Bronson called a flood of adulterated honey coming into the state from overseas about 3 years ago. And the major honey producers had actually asked the Food and Drug Administration to create a standard of identity for honey, but they declined to do so.
So what kind of chemicals are usually used? I know there could be mites in a beehive that sometimes are treated. What other chemicals are used?
Well, I mean, there's a whole range of insecticides that can be used. And plus, with the colony collapse disorder, there's a lot of gray area as to what is being applied to these honeybees and what's really impacting them.
And so this would prohibit all this. That means that any Florida that comes from any honey that comes from Florida, it's like an eco label.
And not comes from Florida, but that's sold in the state. So it can come from North Dakota is the largest producer of honey, and South Dakota is a close second. Any honey from there has to
if it wants
meet
to be sold in Florida.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, fascinating. When is that taking place?
That went into effect on Tuesday.
So that is the law in Florida.
That is the law.
Good for them. Thank you so much, Dan McGovern. And actually, we do have a show on beekeeping and honey in about 2 weeks. So stay put for that. We'll for sure be diving more into Florida's new regulation. Thanks, Dan McGovern with Sustainable Food News.
Thank you, Helga.
Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Helga. It's nice to be here.
What a pleasure. We've known each other for what? 10 years?
Yeah, something like that.
And this is your second book, and it's phenomenal, I must say. I read it throughout the week, and it is utterly hopeful, and yet placed, or the stories you are talking about, it's a very fine line to walk, where it seems so desperate and so hopeless, and yet these are beacons of hope, and I don't know where they get their infusion of hope, where they get the courage to do what they do in a landscape, you know, in the Bay Area, leading perhaps the sustainable food movement in the nation, as many other progressive cities and areas on the coastal areas mostly, but the Midwest, you have experienced a great loss of that culture, of agriculture. What have you seen, and how do you keep yourself hopeful?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I think with regard to these three stories in particular, and I will say they're decidedly not part of those coastal communities, those progressive communities that have really strong support for their alternative farmers, places like San Francisco. I intentionally went outside of this community and sought out people who are kind of satellites out there in the middle of the country. The three stories in the book are an African-American dairy farmer in East Texas named Terry Lewis, and a 10th generation rancher in New Mexico named Virgil Trujillo, and then a sort of modern pioneer family in North Dakota. They're the Podols. And each of them is really operating not only outside of a community of consumers who will support them, but outside of, within an agricultural community that hardly even understands what they're doing. In a lot of cases, it's an affront to the kind of established agriculture of the time.
So the book is called Deeply Rooted. It is available now in bookstores.
Yes, absolutely.
It just came out, 3 weeks ago? It's still hot off the press.
Relatively hot off the press, yeah.
And so you were spending quite some time to win their trust in the beginning. Why did you pick those three particular families that you're describing in Deeply Rooted?
You know, it's a good question. When I set out to write this book, and that began several years ago, I, you know, kind of geeky writer that I am, I started out with this spreadsheet, of course. I go to my, you know, my MacBook and make a spreadsheet. And I had several dozen farmers on there. I've been writing about farmers and ranchers for over 10 years now. So, and writing and focusing mainly on this kind of unconventional farmer and unconventional rancher. So when I sat down to think about a book, there were a lot of people who I had in mind. And gradually I narrowed them down. As I've said before, I wanted to write about people who are working outside of what's familiar to the sort of slow food community. And then I still had, you know, quite a few people throughout the middle of the country and these sort of satellite areas. And ultimately what happened is I've narrowed it down, and these three were the stories that I couldn't not tell. the characters themselves and their histories and the inspiration that they bring, the innovation, and really, and also the struggle and the way that they deal with that, all combined into these compelling stories that meant a lot to me as someone who cares about food and who cares about agriculture. But at the same time, they meant a lot to me as a writer. They were just, you know, I couldn't make up these characters.
And we'll be diving into the stories in a second, and we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
I listen to the wind of my soul. Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 never.
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare. Founded by Janet Lee Katzen, Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica Skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's S-P-H-A-T-I-K-A.com.
Manika Jewelry is a gallery of artisan jewelry made from reclaimed precious metals and Kimberly certified gemstones. Manika Jewelry features local Bay Area artists who craft their beautiful jewelry with a social and environmental awareness in every piece. Manika Jewelry, made with heart and soul, located just off Union Square at 11 Maiden Lane in San Francisco. For more information, please visit manikajewelry.com.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station, open 7 days a week, family owned and operated since 1942, a West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FreyWine.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
And we are back to an organic conversation here on Green 960. I'm your host, Helge Hellberg, and today I'm speaking with Lisa Hamilton, an agricultural writer for over a decade. And I came across your work, Lisa, through publications in Gastronomica and many other magazines, and now a new book, Deeply Rooted, Three Families Throughout the Midwest and New Mexico, telling their story. You said before the break that based on your spreadsheet of all these farmers that you wanted to talk about and write about, those three at the end were the ones you just couldn't cut out. Why? I want to dig a little bit deeper. What makes them so special? Is it the environment that they're in, where there's very little hope left and these are the kind of the beacons of hope, and one wonders what makes them get up in the morning, or why these three?
Well, I think ultimately it was really the writer side of me that was most drawn to these characters. You know, there are, it would be quite wrong to say that these three farmers, or two farmers and a rancher, are unique in that there are people all over the country, even right here in California, who are, you know, operating outside of supportive communities and who are, you know, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps every day because of something that's deep inside of them. That's the agricultural part of these three characters. But the sort of personal and literary draw of them is that their stories are complicated. They're not perfect people. It's a hard thing to put into words, and that's a terrible thing to say as a writer. It's kind of the exact thing that you're not supposed to say as a writer, because you're supposed to be able to put everything into words. But this spirit that's behind these people is the thing that drew me to them and what makes their stories so complex.
And actually, you're in a good environment here, because that's what we are trying to bring out every week with this show, just showing that there is this unknown, there's this creation in earth, there's the spirit, there's the inspiration that comes from working with nature and just knowing that you're doing the right thing. And by reading your book, it's clear that in the lines and between the lines, I don't want to say religious belief, but it's clear that they have found their core truth of how to do things. They really believe in what they're doing every day. Is that what gets them up when you say?
You know, I think that's a big part of it. There's certainly in all three characters, I don't necessarily talk about it in each of their stories, but in all three characters, there's a very strong Christian belief behind what they're doing. In the case of Harry Lewis, the dairy farmer in East Texas, it's kind of an integral part of his story in that he explains the way that he does things, this different way that he does things, that specifically and generally is about pasturing his dairy cattle. He explains it in philosophical terms and in his own version of Christianity.
And it was him where there's a scene in your book where you describe the church, that everything is closed down, the diner, the town basically has left. And yet there's this old little 1920 church that when you were there had, you know, two handful of people, and everyone came because it was the gathering place. It was what was left.
Yeah, this is a story that at the time when I experienced it driving through Balfour, North Dakota, the day after the North Dakota State Fair closed, I was driving through town and I didn't think much of it as I drove through town. You know, it's anyone who's driven across the country and gotten off the interstate, you've been on one of these back highways and driven through, you know, dozens of these tiny towns that have all but closed down. You know, there are a few people still living there. I think there are no more than 20 people still living in Balfour. But I drove through and I was really drawn to this church that was right on the main road. And actually, initially I was drawn in because I saw a sign for a restaurant and I was starving, and it was
That's right. You were looking for food.
Yeah, exactly. I was looking for food, and there was
a different way.
Yeah, exactly. There was absolutely nothing to eat in the town, but right next to their restaurant, there is this old abandoned church, this gigantic church, given, you know, that this is an empty community. It ends up being like four stories tall, including its steeples, and it's inhabited by birds. It's completely abandoned today. Well, I spent a lot of time just kind of looking in at the church. These are the sorts of things that fascinate me. And it felt like a very apt representation of what's happened in a lot of rural America, because agriculture no longer really needs people. Well, as I was kind of, you know, processing this metaphor a little bit and taking photographs and so on, then I got in my car and I just decided to drive down the one block square of downtown Balfour, which is all there is to Balfour. And at the other end of town, I found this little church that it was a newer building. It was much less grand. And inside, there were people singing. And it was Sunday morning, and it was church. There were, again, just a handful of people there. And it didn't hit me at the time, but when I stepped back and I thought about it a little bit, I thought, that's exactly who I'm writing about, those few people who are left. in these small towns who are saying, we do matter. And not only are we going to come together and join hands, we're going to celebrate the fact that we matter. And whether or not anyone hears us, that's secondary. What matters is that we do it.
And I believe the church was Lutheran, but at that point, anyone was welcome, right? But
exactly.
In times of despair, everyone counts, and
exactly.
our boundaries and borders kind of brittle.
Yeah, you could probably be a well-known atheist and go in there and pray on Sunday morning. Exactly.
And get front row seating.
Exactly.
You were saying something just now. Agriculture does not need people anymore. Are you referring to industrial agriculture being highly mechanized and one person with the right equipment can basically farm 20 or 50 or 100,000 acres by himself?
Yeah, I think that's the starting point for it. And that's why this is why we've had this exodus out of rural America, is that you simply don't need people to do the work anymore. But I also mean it on a more conceptual level, which is that agriculture doesn't need humans anymore to be on the ground observing what's happening with crops or with animals, with the relationship between the soil and the machinery and so on.
Why?
The agriculture doesn't need the kind of the human input on the ground level anymore, because it's very easy to, as you say, you know, for one person to farm 500, 1,000, 2,000 acres with a little bit of, you know, hired labor, get all the prescriptions for when to plant, what to plant, and how to plant it from the extension agent or from the seed company, and never make any decisions him or herself. Well, what this book is about is essentially, I mean, this is how I define what an unconventional farmer is they're the people who are saying, actually, the things that we bring to agriculture, whether it's our, you know, our physical labor, our physical presence, or the less quantifiable pieces, we actually matter. The humanity that we bring to agriculture matters. And in fact, it's essential.
And Virgil, for example, the New Mexican rancher, actually attended a holistic research management class in order to apply holistic ranch management in New Mexico, in an area where that's absolutely not common. And I remember reading that he put up electric fences because it's easier to herd his animals this way, which is now a common way to do in sustainable agriculture. He was laughed at. He refers to his peers as laughing his socks off.
It's true.
How did he get into it? Where was that offered? How can you in that area find the resources you need to manifest your belief, like the skills? How did he get access to that?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know where he originally took his first class. He ended up actually being on the board of an organization called the Quivira Coalition, which is based in Santa Fe. And it's a group of ranchers and environmentalists who luckily figured out that they actually want the same thing, which is to preserve land and take care of it. You know, for so long, those two groups in particular have been set against each other, and all they do is butt up against each other. This organization realized that they could actually work together and make a change. Virgil ended up on the board of that organization. They're pretty closely allied with the people doing holistic management. And so even though he started out from this position of kind of being curious and then trying to implement it up where he is in Abiquiu, New Mexico, northern New Mexico, and getting laughed at, he ended up being devoted. And a big part of the reason is that it worked. You know, there's particularly in the West, in the Mountain West, like in New Mexico, there's this kind of cowboy image, or this image that, you know, ranchers have of themselves as cowboys, and the this somewhat traditional approach of grazing, of just setting your cows out on, you know,
in the wild.
Yeah, on like 40,000 acres.
Right.
And
you don't see them for a week.
Well, you don't see them for the season. It's actually referred to as the Columbus method, because you send them out into your 40,000 acres or whatever you have.
Oh, boy.
And then you, at the end of the season, you go out and you discover them. You try to discover where they are. You try to find where the hell they've gone off to, and you bring them in. Well, I mean, that has been, that's at the root of why ranching has had such a such a detrimental effect on, you know, these arid, brittle lands in the West. That's what Virgil's people have been doing for a long time. Well, Virgil found this this way of ranching, of essentially rotational grazing, just on a much larger scale than most people in sustainable agriculture know, and found that it worked, and he had more grass. And
he saves time because he doesn't have to go out for 2 months.
Exactly.
Bringing his cattle back. So access to knowledge is one thing. Access to markets, as agriculture is in large part defined by the economics, is another. Where do these people that are holding up the sustainable torch in areas where there's very little support find their market to sell their products?
Mm. You know, this was a really interesting thing as I went from San Francisco, and particularly Marin County, where I live, where, you know, there's a farmer's market every day of the week. And, you know, if you grow it, people will buy it. I went from there out to a place like Lemoore, North Dakota, which is, you know, the belly of the beast, the industrial commodity farming at its most industrial, I guess I'll put it. That's not true. There's certainly no market for local food. There is a scene in the book where Teresa, who is one of the Podols, one of the farm family there, she is coerced into starting a farmer's market. It's right on the side of the highway there in Lemoore. And in great contrast to, you know, the ferry building here in San Francisco, where people come down with their pretty market baskets and have a kind of experience food and choose carefully and have conversations with the growers and so on. Teresa has this farmer's market in Lemoore. It's pretty small. And, a handful of old ladies descend like piranhas and just tear through the tomatoes and ask when the corn will be there. And then they're out. And that's their access to selling food locally. And so the result is they don't. They sell their grains to an anonymous market. Granted, it's organic, so it may be that you're buying some of it in a health food store, in a natural food store, or even at Whole Foods. But nobody ever knows that it's coming from them.
I'm speaking with Lisa Hamilton about her new book, Deeply Rooted, the story of four families or four farmers, unconventional farmers, throughout the United States in areas where the sustainability movement has not quite reached yet. We're taking a quick break and we'll be right back.
There's a big old hole that goes right through the soul. This old shoe and the water on the ground ain't got no place else it's found. So it's only got one thing left to do. Just creep on in. Creep on in. And once it has begun, it won't stop until it's done. Sneaking in. There's a silver moon. A little too soon. Oh, for me to bear. It shines brightly on my bed, and the shadows overhead won't let me sleep alone.
An Organic Conversation is brought to you by Svatica Skincare, founded by Janet Lee Katzen. Svatica is a holistic approach to skincare that is 100% pure and natural, free of synthetic chemicals, and includes organic and wild-crafted ingredients. For more information about Svatica skincare products and the Svatica Spa, visit svatica.com. That's Svatica.com.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. Please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
Frye Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frye never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frye organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frye Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites, available at grocery stores and online at fryewine.com. That's F-R-E-Y-W-I-N-E.
For the ultimate West Marin experience, visit Toby's Feed Barn in Point Reyes Station, home of the Point Reyes Farmers Market every Saturday. Toby's Feed Barn features organic produce, native plants, gifts, books, an organic coffee bar, an art gallery, concerts, even daily yoga classes. Toby's Feed Barn in downtown Point Reyes Station, open 7 days a week, family owned and operated since 1942. A West Marin original. For more information, visit tobysfeedbarn.com.
Sustainable Food News is the premier source of daily news and market information for the organic, sustainable, and natural food industries. Headline after headline, Sustainable Food News reports on a profound shift in food buying habits as more and more people begin to understand the impact of their purchases on the environment and communities around the world. Join Dan McGovern, publisher of Sustainable Food News, every Saturday morning on An Organic Conversation. For more information, visit www.sustainablefoodnews.com.
And we are back to An Organic Conversation. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg, and I'm speaking with Lisa Hamilton about her new book, Deeply Rooted. And it already got quite some praise. It says, Hamilton is a sensitive, well-versed observer of the American agricultural scene. Deeply Rooted is concentrated, evocative look at agricultural methods that place a premium on health and ecology. And that's the description of the book as well. A critical look into our nation's food system reveals three American farmers in a David and Goliath battle against corporate agricultural practices. For me, I can only highly, highly recommend Deeply Rooted. It's raw and endless and gorgeous because it's not pretty. So Lisa, how did you win the trust of people that usually don't feel supported, I would assume?
Well,
what does it take to get into their space?
Well, you know, the truth is that in my experience of writing about farmers and ranchers, when I have approached people, occasionally I've been rebuffed and stood up at times. But for the most part,
what's people, rebuffed in this case?
Well, you know, showed up at someone's gate at the prescribed time and
see ya.
Yeah, I guess that was the stood up, actually. Rebuffed. Well, you know, there are certain people who just don't want to talk. But it, for me, it has been the minority, the vast majority of people who I've approached. You know, they want to talk. My experience has been that a lot of farmers and ranchers spend their days alone.
Well, Harry Lewis, often, the African-American dairy farmer, certainly wants to talk no matter what, whether it's you. But it's more, where do you get under the belt? Like, where do they let you into their world, really, into their families, into talking beyond the 5 minute, you know, or 1 hour pitch?
Yeah, you know, I think initially when I approach people, they think, great, anyone who wants to hear my story, I'm willing to tell it to. And they'll give you exactly that 5 minute or that 1 hour version, depending how loquacious they are,
yes.
I suppose. But yeah, getting to that next step, it really is a challenge. And the reason is that, you know, most media these days is urban centric. Most reporters who are going out to talk to farmers don't really know the first thing about the issues. They're looking for a soundbite. I've talked to countless farmers who have been misquoted, and actually, you know, that someone has gained their trust and they've been made into the enemy in the final article. And so there's a lot of mistrust with media. But what I say to people, and this is absolutely true, is that my intention is to be a conduit for their voices. And I think you can see that in this book. There's, you know, there's some of my own opinion that comes through, but for the most part, it's really just relaying their stories and trying to tell a truthful version of them. That was particularly true with Virgil Trujillo, who's had a lot of trouble with, he's very popular in some media. He's been misquoted many times, and he told me he doesn't even read the magazine articles that are written about him anymore because he's so tired of them. Well, what I did was I went to him and I said, Virgil, I really want to tell this story from the rancher's point of view. And I said it enough times that he believed me. And really, that's what this is. I would say, you know, when I set out to write this book, part of what motivated me was this sense from having been in food journalism for a long time that there's a whole conversation that's happening about food and the way that we should grow it, the way that we should eat it. But farmers' voices are so rarely part of that conversation. And so that was my original intention with this book, was simply to bring their voices to the table.
Yeah. So as a nation being as disconnected from our food supply and from farming and as we are, just to add some numbers, we are losing about 400 family farms a week. That's 56 farms a day, or one every 25 minutes. And in 2001, the census kind of pulled out agriculture as one of the occupations to rate, because for years, agriculture had been the number one occupation with the highest suicide rate in the nation of any occupation. So as a nation, we have become disconnected from our food. And already in 1913, as you say in your book, Ernest Hilborn basically says, alludes to the fact that it's a deadly cycle. We lose our wheat. We or farmers buy wheat, make more money, buy more wheat, farm more land. And if we lose our farmers as an occupation and as a society, as part of our society, perhaps as the base of our society, we will lose our cities as a consequence. And yet there's this dichotomy. We have this growing sustainable and organic movement, clearly now with Michelle Obama growing an organic garden at the White House, really being in the news every day. What is changing in Central and Middle America, in the Western Belt, that you see where the food movement is reemerging on the coasts, and yet we still have that farm dying and those dead communities in the center? Is something changing there too? Can you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. There are farms just like, you know, we know here in this Bay Area or in Northern California, and just as people around New York City know, you know, small farms run by young people that are organic and ecological. Those exist throughout the country. You know, I think the concentrations of them are a direct result of there being a market, as we were just discussing in, you know, with regard to the podals, there simply isn't a market there. So you have to figure out some other way to do it. I think there's certainly a...
What do they do in this case, this family?
The podals?
Yeah.
Well,
if you can't sell it, you can't, I mean, for your own use maybe, but you got to sell some.
Exactly. Well, they farm grains. And they actually, for a while, were selling their flour directly to people. They were selling it in 5-pound bags. That didn't go very far. And the truth is that the way to make money off of grains is to sell it into an anonymous market, except for, you know, a few a few examples, you know, again, with an urban community. They farm grains, they sell them to a guy in South Dakota, and there's a woman in Connecticut who buys them as well, and they distribute them. But the thing that they have figured out, which I think is really interesting, which is actually a key to their story, is that another thing they've started doing is growing vegetable seed. And the way that I explain the podals is that, just a little bit of background, they decided back in the 1970s that the primary focus of their farm was going to be to feed themselves. Well, this is a revolutionary idea in North Dakota. People grow commodity crops generally and shop at the supermarket. Well, the Podols did that. They ended up today with 2 acres that's devoted to exclusively to their own food production. Well, what's happened over time is that the relationships and the values and the attitudes from that that sort of feed ourselves first philosophy and the lessons that they learned in the garden doing that have extended out into the way that they run the rest of their farm. One of the outcomes has been that they now grow vegetable seed. And they've even done a little plant breeding on their own. And the result of that has been this, they have a sort of a line of unique vegetable varieties. And they name each of one of them with the word Dakota in the name, so that's kind of marked as their own. They don't own them. They're all open pollinated public varieties. But like Uncle David's Dakota Dessert Squash, and I've heard from a number of people who are growing some of these Dakota varieties. They're sold through Seeds of Change and others. So they found a way to go through what is normally an anonymous market and personalize it.
Which is beautiful, that nature will always come through, right? If we have the openness and creativity to see it, there's always a way. And it's coming basically through in every story of your book, that if we want to hold true to our own inner truth, in this case, these three farmers, they all figured it out enough to at least, survive and somewhat thrive and be economically viable.
Yeah, and part of that, themselves. I think, is adopting or fashioning and then adopting a different set of priorities. They don't care about, none of these families cares about making a lot of money. And they're all struggling to some degree financially. And that's okay with them because there are these other rewards. It sounds, it sounds hokey, but it's true.
What's your favorite part of being a writer, picking agriculture? Why agriculture? What is food? Why food for you?
Well, without a question, the reason why I'm in it and the most fun thing about it, the most interesting thing about it, is just hearing people's stories and going out to farms and kind of learning about the way that things work. I've been doing this for over 10 years now, and still every time I go out to a farm, I learn something new about the way that plants work, about the way that animals grow.
But why is that fascinating to you? You could go out and study elk.
Yeah. It's a good point.
As long as you don't eat it, I'm just saying anything.
It's true. Well, I grew up in suburban Boston and more or less hadn't set foot on a farm until I was in college. And I was studying community development there at Evergreen State College in Washington. And there's a great organic farming course at that college. And so in my class, there were a few people who were studying agriculture, one in particular, Jim McGinn, who actually was just featured in that USA Today article about young farmers, which I was so pleased about. Jim McGinn sort of opened my eyes to all kinds of things about food and farming, but in particular, this idea that food and farming could be a method for community development. So I switched over my studies and I started going out to farms and just talking to farmers, kind of exactly the thing that I'm doing today. And right from the start, I learned about this different set of relationships to life, these biological relationships to life, cultural, at times philosophical and spiritual, political. And it was something that I'd never had access to before, particularly not growing up in suburban Boston. And, there's this wonderful quote by John Cage, the composer. He said his kind of prescription for life was, or his advice was, find something outside of yourself that is yourself and devote yourself to it. And that's what happened for me with farming.
I'm speaking with Lisa Hamilton, author of the book Deeply Rooted. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. Lisa, what's your most favorite and least favorite moment that you had writing this book? Was there, is there something sticking out where, I mean, you've traveled for weeks and months and maybe years.
Yeah.
If you tally it all up.
Yeah.
Through areas we will never even find.
You know, I'd have to say that my my least favorite moment, without a doubt, was in North Dakota. And it was a certain motel in North Dakota that hadn't vacuumed their floors for about, I don't know, 2 years or so. And it's the only place to stay. And I stayed there for 2 weeks. They had ripped up half of their carpet, and it was all construction workers and me. I don't have any problem with construction workers, but it was a sort of a level of comfort. I'm kind of a wimp about the heat, and it was like 100 degrees there every day, and coming back to this miserable motel was kind of the low point of, you know, this supposedly glamorous life of being out on the road as a writer. In fact, you're like in this really dingy motel with no natural light and like gravel on the floor. That sticks out as a low point. High point, God, there were so many, but I feel pretty sure that even if I sat here and thought about it for an hour, that I would still think the high point was what comes in the very end of the story with Virgil Trujillo, which is, and I'm not going to ruin the story, but
I'll say that. Do you want to read it, or do you want to?
No, you know, it's a little too long, but it's the whole last chapter. But he took me out on a roundup with his in November, going and getting his cattle at the end of the season. And
what's a roundup exactly?
You know,
because people are sensitive about roundup.
Okay. No, this is a cattle roundup. We all got on our horses, and I went out with Virgil and then two guys, Pepo and Humphrey, and we went out riding for the day and rounded up cattle. And you know, the truth is that I had asked Virgil if I could go along on the roundup for weeks. And I had never mentioned the fact that I'm not a great horse rider.
And it's dangerous, right? This is, I mean, we're talking hundreds of animals, thousands?
No. It wasn't quite that big. It was probably, they had already brought a lot of them in. So we were probably dealing with 50 to 100. You know, and the rest of the guys were really experienced. And the cows are pretty docile. So it wasn't so dangerous in that. But it became clear pretty soon off that I was not a great horse rider. And one of the things that made this day so great, aside from having my sort of city slickers moment of like, I'm a cowgirl, was that when I got out there and it became clear to everyone that I was not a good rider, it didn't faze Virgil. He is such a kind and gentle and generous man. He just decided to take it slower that day. And, you know, the truth is we didn't get done until dark, but he didn't mind. He just liked being out there.
And I'm sure the other cowboys didn't mind protecting you from any
Well, they were so drunk that it didn't really matter. So, yeah, they didn't care what was going on.
Do you want to read one favorite part out of the book, a paragraph or two?
Sure,
yeah. I would just love to hear how somebody who wrote this reads it.
Yeah, you know, I'll read a piece that isn't a, I don't know, particularly telling or anything. It was another kind of favorite moment from the book, or from the writing of the book, and this is in North Dakota.
Lisa Hamilton, author of Deeply Rooted.
I'll give a very short introduction, which is to say that...
That was the introduction.
What? The quick introduction being that when I arrived in North Dakota, I kind of knew it like everybody else does, the just flat expanse of nothingness. And I gradually came to understand the land. And this was the first step in that. My first lesson came in the form of a snowstorm in southeast North Dakota on the second day of April. A week before, it had been 70 degrees. And even just earlier that afternoon, the land had been soggy and turning green in places. Driving west on Highway 13, I could see the white tundra swans against the black ground from a half mile away. But as I entered Lemoore County, a gray curtain pulled down from the sky. announcing what seemed to be an executive decision that winter was not over just yet. Over the next 12 hours, 3 inches of snow fell. The swans vanished, and the world became overrun with pheasants, their dark bodies naked against the backdrop of white.
The snow itself wasn't shocking. A person doesn't have to know North Dakota intimately to know the winters here are brutal and long. What struck me instead was what the snow did after it had fallen. Over the days that followed, it drifted without rest, a tireless white migration from north to south. It flowed over the east-west roads like a sideways waterfall, low and steady, stopping only to pile up at the rare tree or stand of withered cattails. As I watched it, I realized that what I was seeing was really wind. Wind given body by the snow. I could read forever. I'm going to stop here at the same page open, page 214 of Deeply Rooted. My guest today, Lisa Hamilton. Lisa, you have some a speaking tour coming up. Where are you next?
Yeah, several things are about to happen next weekend. I'm going to be at the Point Reyes Bookstore in Point Reyes, California on Saturday night.
Yeah, since this show is podcast too, we should say the date. Otherwise, yes. Hundreds of thousands of people will come to Point Reyes Books in Point Reyes.
And I'm sure they wouldn't mind that, actually. The show was 2 months ago. So. July 25th, 2009. At 7 o'clock, I'll be at the Point Reyes Bookstore. And then the next day, Sunday, July 26th, I'll be at the Civic Center Farmers Market in Marin County, starting at 10 a.m., doing some readings and a panel with some farmers.
Okay, say it again. July 25th at 7 o'clock at Point Reyes Books.
Yes.
In Point Reyes Station.
Yes.
And the second reading?
July 26th, Sunday morning at 10 a.m. at the Civic Center Farmers Market in San Rafael in Marin County, doing a reading and some book signing and then a panel with some of the market farmers.
That's the morning after.
Yes.
So you can't get stuck at the Western in Point Reyes Station again.
Or just pull an all-nighter.
And people can buy books there. You're signing them, I guess.
You'll sign them. Yes, books for sale and signing.
And do you have a website where people can follow you?
I do. I have my own website. It's lisamhamilton.com.
And of course, all that information is on our website at anorganicconversation.com, also now on iTunes. Lisa, thank you so much. That was so fun.
Oh, thank you, Helga. This has been great.
I have nothing to do with this book, and I feel really proud. This is beautiful, and this will go a long way to help in the understanding of rural communities and farmers that, yes, do this as the foundation for all of us, as the foundation for life in this nation and beyond. So thanks for all your work.
Thank you. It's incredible. Thank you.
And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thanks again to Lisa Hamilton and her new book, Deeply Rooted, for coming to the studio on this beautiful day and for sharing your story and all the stories in the book. An Organic Conversation is produced by Jen Lloyd. Production assistant is Kristen O'Heary. Underwriting production provided by Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all, and always thanks here to the team at Green 960, Chelsea Mauck, Mark McNown, John Scott, and John Plessis. And of course, thank you, our listeners, for being part of the show and for actually listening. Tune in next week. We'll be speaking about food justice movements in the San Francisco Bay Area. For blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com. You can also find us now on iTunes, where you can download An Organic Conversation to your iPhone or iPod and take us with you wherever you go. We love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share@anorganicconversation.com. Coming up next is the Gavin Newsom Show, so please stay put. I'm your host, Helga Hellberg. Have a great weekend, and thanks again for listening to An Organic Conversation here on Green 960.
And down your streets I've walked alone, as if my feet were not my own. Such is the path I chose, doors I have